Actually, there's a good article on, I have this packet here, from Micro Content News. It actually compares.
Compares the blog posts?
Yeah.
That's actually a really good one.
I think one of the things he links to there is the is a blog feature list comparison too.
Can
I say something? I found that project very important.
Micro Content News.
And I've got the URL for that on the site.
Do we want to circle back to the conversation to knowledge management, or
well, that's the critical issue, isn't it?
The question becomes, right? Because knowledge is one of those ephemeral things, right? The idea of managing knowledge is like a slippery concept that, like, you know, runs away from you. Bear in mind, right, at a minimum, you've got the knowledge capture issue, okay, which means getting some kind of formal representation of knowledge, or in a blog, an informal representation of knowledge. Any representation is better than no representation, which is the current state in 99.73% of all organizations. Okay? So a blog gives you a way to capture it. You tie a search engine in or some other app mechanism, that gives a retrieval mechanism. Now, is that true knowledge management? The theorists will argue no. Why? There's no taxonomy, there's no full 50 other CAM buzzwords out there, none of them, right? But the honest God truth about this is it'll get you closer to real CAM than anything else because people would use it. Okay? People don't use formal software. This is why CAM is a $0 billion business. Okay? It's a $0 billion business because all of us build these prototypes or built these prototypes. We went off and we sold the code for, you know, we sold it to commercial companies like AT&T Global Solutions, the US Navy, etc. They spent like $250,000 for software, they spent $250,000 in implementation, and they ended up with a very good virtual paperweight. Right? Because if you throw a CAM system and no one comes to play, it's a paperweight.
I think there is a lot of opportunity to bring taxonomy back into weblogs, particularly a collection of weblogs. Most weblog engines and tools right now allow you to create your own categories, okay? And it's basically just a flat categorization. It's just basically a straight list that you can edit and update and then just categorize your individual postings, either using a select or a multiple select drop-down list. There's a multiple select list. So, because sometimes your postings will fit into more than one of your categories. Now, as I was saying earlier, there's of course a temptation if you have a whole group of weblogs to impose even that flat categorization hierarchy from above and make everybody use the same one. You know, the big mistake, we already covered why, because nobody's going to use it. Or they'll start deliberately using the wrong one. A slightly different approach is to let each individual weblog author create their own little categorization list, and then match up or aggregate the ones whose category labels actually match, which in certain circumstances will never happen, in other circumstances it will, especially if their list is short. But there's also an opportunity to then take those categories that happen to match, okay, and presenting them in a list that other people who are writing their weblog in this weblog file can easily add back from that data list into their own categorization list. Okay. Basically, what you're doing in that case is you're actually getting people to share their categorization information and to collaboratively create a larger categorization scheme. As far as I know, nobody's doing it yet. I intend to do it in my tool, and I intend to license it under the AGPL. So if anybody is the AGPL is basically the Affero GPL. Depending on how you look at it, it's either a more restrictive or a more permissive version of the GPL. Basically, it mandates that not only do you give the source to people to whom you give copies of the software, but if this is assuming that the software in question is actually a web service, whether it's through a web browser or some other layer. But also the people who are just using the software remotely also have the right to get the source code.
Okay.
The reason for that is because otherwise, if I set up, create a weblog tool, this is an example, that runs on a web server, and I license it under the GPL, and then somebody takes my weblog tool, and they set up call it blogger2.com. All the people who are using that server-side tool, okay, and they make a whole bunch of changes to it, they can keep those changes proprietary because they're not redistributing the software. They're just making the software available for use over the network.
Right.
The AGPL plugs that particular hole in the GPL. And it's actually...
Yes, but it's like Google not releasing their stuff because they're not really selling the product. They're just as a service.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it plugs the web services hole in the GPL. It's not suitable for everything, but since the weblog tool I'm writing is a server-side tool in its entirety, it is in my case, and I do want to make sure that it remains free software.
Is that a free software foundation license?
Affero is a nonprofit, and they basically got the Free Software Foundation's permission to modify the GPL in this particular way. It is authorized by the FSF.
Should I return to your PAM topic and take, of course, a dissenting view?
Sure. I just had one question. It seems to me I have a similar problem at Columbia where we're collecting video. All our students have to take videos of themselves while they're doing student teaching. And so we have a massive database of videos of various different teaching, like mathematics in third grade. So we can categorize some of these videos, define them according to certain criteria that are actually not disputable. I mean, they're pretty clear. But then we tried to have... It's not very interesting to search by those necessarily. So you might want to be able to search by style of teaching or something like that. And so we collected from the professors, what are the schools of teaching, right? Which were totally and absolutely useless when the students went to go, And so I asked students to propose different categories of teaching, and they didn't feel like they could. The conclusion I came to from this exercise was this is really hard not to crack, but that collecting data from the users one at a time by having people vote on the content. So you had sort of a fuzzy quantification and they could change over time is really probably the best way to collect metadata if you can motivate people to vote. Or you can capture their click-throughs or something. So over time, the database becomes more valuable rather than less data.
In my example, the people who are using their individual weblogs are already self-categorizing because they're motivated to do that.
But you wanted to respond to that.
Yeah, I actually did want to respond to the whole categorization thing where you look at that and, you look at the most effective search tool on the internet, Google, and they don't use categories, and you actually have things like the stuff Cameron is doing with Blogdex. You have stuff like Daypop, and you have these things that don't use categories or schemas at all.
It only works if you have a large number of weblogs to aggregate, though.
Keep going.
There are some things that are interesting as far as, I guess. You can actually group their, there was this, the previous, that Java applet that takes all the links of who links to who and it sort of shows this whole view of the blogosphere? Where you can actually do searching perhaps by, domain specific web blogs, they're the war bloggers, now and all those people who, are off in their whole entire world but apparently are, much more well-read and are getting all this press because, they reach this entire larger audience. I mean, I'm a blogger who started, you know, like 98 or so. And, you know, like, there, I am, you know, basically, you know, related with all these old school bloggers, but we have nothing to do at all with the larger blogging community now because so many people are doing it. And then you do have, like, all these live journal, you know, whatever, the 15-year-old goth girls doing their whole thing, you know, and there are these, yeah, entirely different domains. And so, you know, we could data mine that, I guess, but...
Yeah. A couple of comments on categorization.
Feel free to come
I intend to. Okay. As a general rule of thumb, okay, people are shitty at search, and they're even worse at categorizing information.
Okay.
That's pretty much a fact.
Sure.
15 years of building search engines has told me that, and every library I've ever met has told me that. Okay. The most important thing here isn't categorizing the information. The most important thing here is capturing it. Anything you put in the way of knowledge capture, even if it's making people apply simple-ass categories, means they may be less likely to actually do it. Okay? So as a general rule of thumb, look at the audience who's creating the content. Now, I'm clearly a geek, so for me to check off checkboxes or do something categorized isn't a big deal because I have a real motivated interest. For your audience, for example, maybe they do, maybe they don't. Okay, now your audience is a little different because they know how to search, so you want a blog system that's searchable because it turns out to search.
Yeah, and like you said, Google does a great job just with the search, but
correct.
You've got text. When I talk about videos, the problem with that, you don't have text. We have text.
Correct.
Search the text. You know?
Yeah. So for categorization, it's a great concept. People do it poorly, and people will always do it poorly because we don't think like librarians, right? Because in order to do it, you have to pull yourself out of your own body. You have to say, how would someone want to find this? And then those are the categories you want to apply to. That's non-trivial, okay? Now, to get back to your comment on the video stuff, it's a very interesting problem, and I'd like to talk to you offline. Because that's a real, very serious information management problem, and you can do a lot of things with it. You're on the right track.
Just to toss out two really quick ideas for categorization. What if you did a single list of categories blogs, but anyone could add?
Anyone could apply a category?
That's cool.
Yeah, everybody could add it to the big list.
Yeah, choose among these 12 or add a new one.
Well, of course, you'll have an infinitely long list.
Right.
Well,
the idea of categorization is to control vocabulary.
Controlled vocabulary. Yeah, controlled vocabulary is a huge problem. People will put an SC to something. Exactly. No, yeah, we're working. Yeah, I'm at a library and we'll have UFC. Exactly.
What I'm trying to do, which is in an enterprise, categorize not the entry but the blog, you know, by communities of practice. We've got Java developers, it's got
the thing is that people are, but that's just it. The people are going to, we want to overlap in communities.
Yes, they are.
So, and so that's why categorizing the postings works because a posting will be relevant to one or more communities. And then you can pull out all the postings that are relevant to a particular category.
That's true, but as you were saying, you don't want to make them fill in another box.
Only if it's easy enough for them to do it.
Each posting may be relevant to several categories, then you got to go, well, that one and that one.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I know this sounds like I'm saying users are stupid and they can't be bothered, and I'm not really.
Users are stupid and they can't be bothered.
Well, no.
Well, I mean, look, how many people...
Users are really fucking smart these days. I disagree with you.
Okay.
Users are really smart. What they are, though, is they're busy and they're lazy. Okay? So when you ask them to do something, if you give them the opportunity to screw it up, they probably will. Because they don't care that much about... They care about their business goals. They don't care about the fact that it's a blog. So, I mean, just, you know, make it easy.
Well, like, my users in this case are attorneys, and like Bill, the attorney for our company, blows me away what this guy remembers, and he's brilliant.
Yep.
But he can't use his computer for crap, you know? He has no patience for it, you know? If he can't do something immediately, he just calls somebody in to help him do it, because he's not going to waste an extra second doing it.
That's right. Because his time's worth like $250 an hour, right?
Yeah, I mean, just a simple example, you know, we're all pretty much geeks, but I mean, you know, how many people here actually blog? And, you know, you guys all use a blogging tool. But, I mean, the thing is, if you look at, you know, let's say before Blogger came along, I mean, what are the steps that you're actually removing when you're doing blogging, you know, with a blogging tool? Is you're just removing the step of actually opening up a text editor, you know, adding the thing to the top or whatever, and, you know, FTPing it. Or, you know, if you're going, you know, telnetting or SSHing in and editing thing in VI, you know, like, what you're actually saving is so little, but yet that little step of, you know, making it so easy to blog,
it's huge,
exactly.
You're like 1,000% right.
Like, we use web blogs for status report collecting.
Oh, cool.
For our group.
Yeah.
And so basically they select from a selected template, there's about six categories, and every time someone enters a status report for that month, say I worked on a shuttle or whatever, I would select shuttle, and that goes into that category. So at the end of the month, because they're archived by category and by month,
yep,
the status collector just grabs that one web block, could import it to, actually created a HTML to RTF so that they had input to Word special template.
Yep.
And a lot of users, some of the feedback I got was that they didn't want to go through a web interface.
Really?
So what I had to do is create a macro, a Word macro that actually imports into the web block.
Yep.
And some people are not willing to use a web interface, even though it's as simple.
Well, you know, text editing web browser sucks. There's no two ways about it.
Because everybody's used to the bolding and all that italicizing.
Yeah.
Is that using the PocketSoap implementation?
What was that?
Your macro.
Yeah.
Is that using the PocketSoap
implementation? Yeah. Is soap.
And that worked well?
Yeah. Well, to a certain point, sometimes you get weird. It's not perfect.
But
it does. At least it extracts the title
And
gets the content, puts it into a body.
Cool.
And
it
selects the category too.
Our data is very complex in the mortgage industry, and we're doing a lot of web start stuff now because the user interfaces have to be really, really smart. I mean, you know, when you change this field, these things have to gray, and that tab disappears, and, and you click that one, and then it hits the server to find out what displays down there, and I mean, they're going to town, you know, and it saves people a lot of time, and people love them, but they have to load Java 1.3, the whole swing deal, you know, it's 5 meg or something, but it's, you know, they're all on fast links, it's really not that bad, you know, we get them over that hump, and then they can run all our stuff, so, you know, that would be, if we home grow something, that might be the way, you know, we go, which is a possibility.
Yeah,
just web started, and then they get a full app, bang, but we have all the advantages of server side.
Correct. And you know something? Ain't hard to write blogging tools, guys. Mm-hmm. It's really simple.
The hard thing is deciding what to do exactly. Why I'm here talking about this, because...
But that's always the case.
Yeah, exactly. And I have some offshore guys that do some programming for us, and they could bang something like this out. They're great user interfaces and server side stuff and all that. The hard thing with those guys especially is I have to describe... just excruciating detail. Exactly what it does, or it's just not going to do what I want. You know?
That's exactly correct.
My current really crappy web blog implementation, which I basically cranked out in a total of about, I don't know, 12 hours over several days, is really stupid and simple, but the usability on it actually sucks even for me. Which is why I'm actually building something that's actually good the second time around. But I actually could have made my life a heck of a lot easier if I had aimed a little bit lower just for my first revision. Actually, calling it a first revision is actually a bit of a misnomer because my second version is not going to share any code at all.
What's that written in?
Well, because I actually built it in Zope, I leveraged Zope's interface. So actually, what I'm doing in the post for me is actually copying and pasting a template and then editing it and then making it, clicking a button to make it publish. Just that extra cutting and pasting step, you know, is a real hindrance, which is why I haven't updated my own weblog in over a month.
Does anybody have a rule of thumb on like one click more cuts off like 60% of the users, and then one more click cuts off another 60% of the users? Because the threshold seems to be really sensitive. If we have a rule of thumb, I could use it with my vice president of RT. Okay.
If you went to and looked into what's called SIGCHI, which is the ACM Special Interest Group on Computer-Human Interaction, they could, anyone who's a SIGCHI member can tell you like almost immediately, and I can give you a pointer. So
great.
But there are definite
0.1 second for real time. That's the biggest thing about, you know, with doing web editing is that if you have to reload a page, it's a huge problem. That's one of the great things about, you know, recently. There are a lot of, if you're doing you know, JavaScript interface, I do, you know, back end and front end work, and yeah, if you're going to do DOM stuff, you can do dynamic insertions. If you're ever doing any form submission type stuff, use an iframe to act against. If you can't, you know, use DOM methods. I was actually just over at the Mozilla, you know, birds of a feather thing, and bitching at them because, you know, their text ranging is still broken on text areas. 2 years ago, I was trying to copy, you know, I was actually talking to, you know, the Pyra guys, and that was one of the big things. They just did their whole, you know, IE event key thing, control shift B will, you know, do bold and stuff, and all kinds of sexy stuff, you know, which is, like, you know, like, for their Pyra app, it was the same way, where functionality-wise, it didn't do that much, but it was all about the user interface, which...
Right. Yeah. Evan gets that.
Exactly. And, you know, I was trying to do that. I ended up, you know, there's no documentation, so I had to, you know, go through the source and find out that the get selection method they had was an empty function. And, you know, filed the bug. The bug was, you know, actually in their Zool implementation to, you know, get that is in their Zool core, and then it kept getting delayed from, you know, like, okay, we'll fix this in 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, you know, 1.01 now, 1.1. It's still not fixed. Recently, they did do text ranging for, you know, in text areas for the HTML stuff, but the problem, of course, is there's still that internal problem, and so internally, it actually handles multiple text lines as separate text nodes, but there's no way to access it through JavaScript, and so whenever you do your start and end on your selections now, it counts from the first line, so you're on the second line doing your selection, but it'll only affect, you know, the offsets on the first line. Which is just, yeah, I mean, it's horrible and a huge point of contention, but, you know, when I was designing my interfaces, you know, the thing is that in many ways, you know, Mozilla is awesome because, you know, it has pretty much the best DOM implementation ever, and with their DOM inspector and their, you know, now they rewrote Venkman, so it's just the best thing, you know, since sliced bread for doing DOM stuff. But yeah, so that's, you know, it's a huge issue, and that's one of the things why you might want to do a Java interface, or, you know, that I was looking into XWT, which is, you know, XML windowing toolkit, or, you know, NetWindows, or any of those things, just because, you know, it all comes down to, you know, when people are going to use this, you know, it's all about the interface.
So I know, and Gray Matter actually provides, you could actually blog, or post a blog through email, just a simple subject and body, and send it to a specific email address, and it...
Yeah, just removing two clicks from, you know, an internal application we were working on for doing, you know, time tracking.
Yeah.
Just by removing two clicks, it went from something that, you know, no one in our work group used to something that, you know, we were able to use, basically everyone were able to use it every day.
Now,
so
I hate to point this out, but there is actually a rich editor in Flash that can be embedded as a blog component. Now, I don't know a single person who's ever done it, and I'm not certain that it actually exposes the right properties, but it does actually exist.
I thought someone did write a blogger API tool in Flash.
What I'm talking about I think they actually did, but there's a separate thing. There's somebody wrote an actual, like, a GUI-style editor as a Flash component.
Oh, okay, so the next step.
It would be the next step, and then you could theoretically drop that in any page that's hosting your blogging tool, and actually have, like, bold-facing and
stuff. Well, the new version of Flash is supposed to have a whole...
Flash MX, is really nice. It actually has full, you know, XML RPC services built in, and it's this thing called Components, which is not as good as they want to make you believe, because,
correct,
you know, the way they load up the libraries is, it's like, what's the point? Because you have to, but...
Regarding your text area bug, have you tried getting that added to the umbrella bugs that make Mozilla advocacy hard bug?
No, I know that it is pretty active. Actually, the last patch was submitted the 15th, where the guy who's been working on that has is working on the multi-line fix. It's sort of funny because there are several bugs. There's also actually the content editable bug as well, which is a separate bug because IE now has sort of taken this huge step forward where you can actually set the content editable property and you can do HTML editing within the page, which is just, already they're so far ahead because they do, with ActiveX support, there are tons of rich text control edits there. They have text areas that work, which is also, although, they don't support DOM2 ranging, but via their selection method, you can actually, hack in. That's, how originally, Paul Bausch wrote that originally. It is sort of, a little sticking point where, I love Mozilla, use it for everything, and, as a user, it's tons better. As a developer, even, I swore off DOM after, that whole period, 2 years ago when I was working on this stuff, I swore it off until, I'm not doing anything until 1.0, and unfortunately, there's still, there actually is some documentation now, and there have been a lot of people working on it. Exactly. But, although now with Venkman, with their JavaScript debugger, is the best thing ever. So, and the DOM inspector, where you can change things in real time. Now, the pain in the ass is that, you're still dealing with, for example, Blogger right now has a bug on the entry for their CSS, for, the entry form. And actually, I sent them a fix, about a week or two ago. Ev doesn't answer email anymore, so I sent this thing off to Shellen, and we'll see if that actually gets fixed or anything, but, it's been a while.
None of us answer email anymore.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm sorry, Google, that I have to write to, forms to any browser. It just gives me nightmares.
No, although I was looking at I went to the XForm session today, and unfortunately, they're not building in some stuff that would be really helpful for XForms. Like, it does stuff like you're like, why bother type stuff, but they don't do stuff like, originally that was actually going to be in the original HTML spec, would be like nesting selects, so you can do, subgroups on options.
Yes.
And they took that, Tim Berners-Lee decided against it, and then it's something that, we've been missing ever since, and it's just horrible on some of the things
deeply
you have to do with.
Deeply missing it.
Exactly. No, it's just amazing how much forms suck, but they've been here since, and they haven't changed.
Yeah, but guys,
they stuck
I predate the web since I started building hypertext shit in 87. The web is like the most fantastic thing in the world. Why? Because it friggin' works. Mm-hmm. Okay. And anyone who's doing hypertext in the pre-web days, we all think the web sucks because we did all this shit way before. And you know something? All of our proprietary little architectures, blue-green cookies.
But, the data entry, though, you go on a VT100 system or any of those, old mainframe systems, and data entry is just so much more efficient than...
We still have users that are green screen, and they just fly in those things.
They do.
That's why we can't replace that GUI, because they're so fast on it. You can't replace it. You can't give them a mouse. They'll just go, I'm going to grab that. That's going to slow me down.
That's one of the things, I'm using OS 10 now, and it's, in most ways, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
But one...
Keyboard access,
you go and you get a modal dialog box up, and you're like, oh, I should be able to, tab or left or right. No, nothing. It's horrible.
God help you. If you're trying to do, the alt-tab between things, why can't you go actually into a specific instance instead of the application as a whole?
Yep. No, it's
we kind of have three tiers how we do our website. If someone's going to come in, they got to do it, the first time they come into our website, potential customers and stuff, make it easy. It runs on any platform. It's lowest common denominator. Internet stuff, you can specify a browser, make it IE, do just IE stuff, make it trickier.
Yep.
And then any more than that, it's going to get used once a week or more, make it a web start, and give them a full Java GUI. So, now we don't have to deal with that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
But it limits us. Yeah, it's still a limit.
Well, we're way off topic.
Should we just keep talking about Blogger? Because that's the fun thing these days. Because if we homegrow one, though, I have to think of how to do the interface. So to bring it back around, that's probably the way. It gets possible. Used enough to be a web start to me. It's a Java app. It's Swing. You got all the, all the tricky stuff you can do. You can hit the server. When you need to.
Yeah. The one thing I would comment to you is, you're going to find that your blog authors that you think are going to only do it from their desktop at work, they're going to actually want to do stuff from home.
Well, that's the thing. The web start will load right up. They'll have to load the 5 meg once.
If they've got the Swing stuff installed.
Well, they'll load the 5 meg once, but it's pretty automated.
Do you want that accessible outside the firewall?
What's that?
If you're going to do it, make an HTML interface as well. And you wouldn't think that it's going to be required, but they're going to find themselves on some terminal, some box.
Or Conker won't load Java right or something.
It won't load Java right.
Yeah.
I mean, look at me. You know, I mean, I write a very high traffic blog, and I can't do it remotely. You know, I mean, that just sucks.
Why don't people use more an email interface that you're talking about? Was it Gray Matter?
Gray Matter.
I mean, all of the email have rich text editors
It's one of those things that I said.
And you can categorize with the subject line.
Well, the only downside to that is the only thing that you're sure of is the subject. The subject heading would be the title, and the body is that. You can't rely on the user putting a colon for the category.
Yeah.
Well, I think the problem too is if you mess it up and it hits the site, then what do you do?
Yeah. Yeah. The problem there is you're talking about the thing you're fighting there is user fear. Okay. Then one of the nice things about blogs, and anyone who has a blog has probably done this, you post, you jump to your blog, you make sure it looks okay, you find out you screwed it up, you jump back, and you make 5 more changes, okay? And you're all doing it in real time, because none of these things have decent draft.
So you have to edit what you did anyway.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, and with the email interface, as I said, I know one person who uses it, and he manages to get it right, but even he, when he wrote an entry for my radio fact, said, be really careful. Because you will find out that you put something out there that you did not intend to go public with. Something often embarrassing. Or you'll find like your whole blog will disappear because there's some kind of HTML error in your rich email. Okay, so all of a sudden you get one of those wonderful angle brace problems where everything disappears. So it's one of those, the posting by email is a great concept.
Yeah.
I wouldn't trust it as far as I can throw it.
The KM community is starting to notice blogs, at least. I don't know that they really know what to make of them, and I don't think they quite comprehend the threat
they
blogs pose.
They don't get it.
Yeah.
A friend of mine writes KMConnection.com, and he's been doing KM for a lot of years, and I've been trying to suck him in to the whole blogging thing, and he just doesn't get it. Because as we've all seen, right, until you're a blogger, you think this is kind of this, well, stupid, self-referential, intellectual masturbation, right? But you know, once you do it, you realize exactly how simple it is, and consequently how powerful it is.
Yeah.
So.
There are some ways.
Let me give an example of just a personal one. I actually haven't been web blogging for more than a few months. The immediate impetus to start my own web blog was I was going for a trip in Israel for Passover. And so I started web blogging basically the same day that I managing it through after I set it up on the server before I left. Basically managing everything through the browser on my laptop. And about 5 days after I arrived in Israel, the Passover massacre happened in the same town where I used to live and was currently visiting. And it turned out that none of the bloggers who actually lived in Israel had very much exposure internationally. But here I was with a weblog less than a week old, and Dave Weiner links to it. And suddenly, people are linking to my weblog postings about terrorist bombings in Israel from not only all over the U.S., but all over the world. That's powerful. That's really powerful. I didn't have a high traffic web blog. I actually have absolutely no idea how Dave Weiner found my web blog in the first place, except I was making sure to update weblogs.com.
That's how I found it. Yeah. Dave watches weblogs.com like a hawk.
Yeah.
He's very good at it.
So that's really powerful. A completely unknown web blogger just happened to be in the right place in the right time, and suddenly. I had my lever on the blogosphere fulcrum and just getting huge exposure. I was blown away. And top it all off, when I got back from Israel, the day after I arrived back in the U.S., I was woken up in the morning by a call from Tech TV. and they wanted to do an on-air interview with me on blogging the Middle East crisis. I had, and at that point, my weblog was all of about 2 weeks old. Okay,
because see, like, you'd have 15 minutes of fame, yeah, like 2 weeks of fame.
And of course, it's dropped off a bit since, especially since I've stopped blogging on that particular topic all that much. It's just become too wrenching. But I mean, how else could I ever have gotten that kind of attention in the real world, okay, from doing something on the internet? Within 2 weeks, I was on TV. Weblogs are extraordinarily powerful, and unless you
the web is so powerful, like you're saying, you know, we didn't have tools like that. The web is incredibly powerful because it's simple.
Because
basically
it's simple.
It's text.
Because it's limited, it's just fantastic.
Right.
That's a great story. You know, it's like he's on TV because he has a blog. I mean, that's
for
cool.
After 2 weeks.
And of course, I
get stage fright. In fact, I have stage fright right now. I was woken up in the morning by Tech TV. They sent a limo out. The limo took me to this little on the wall TV studio where they stuck me inside of what was literally practically a broom closet with a camera in it, and sat me in front of this background and interviewed me remotely. And basically, you know, they used probably about 2 or 3 minutes of the total thing on air, maybe once or twice. Now, the interesting thing is, because Tech TV is, some of Tech TV segments are carried on the Israeli internet and high-tech cable channel, a few Israeli bloggers in Israel actually got to see my interview in the States after it was broadcast there about 5 or 6 days later. It blew me away.
That's really cool. You know, and then you get this of course naturally takes us the whole is blogging journalism debate, which I don't even touch. I mean, just who cares? It's interesting. Yeah. But this brings us around to what you were saying at the beginning. You were indicating that you don't like to blog because, well, there's the whole stage fright. You know, you don't like to put yourself out there. But what you've realized is that blogging is useful for yourself. Okay? In other words, it gives you a way to easily capture knowledge that you might necessarily need again. A lot of my blog entries are things that I either need to remember, things I need to train my business partner in, or things I know I need to get back to. And I lose bookmarks, right? We don't have them when we travel, etc. My blog is always out there. I know if I put a link there, I can probably find it in the blog. Maybe.
But comment on bookmarks, I find that, basically, all the bookmarks that I actually have are useless. That's not entirely true. I mean, sometimes when I bookmark a specification or something like that, it's useful. Anything else, I actually remember the URL, and the bookmarks that I do have of sites that I used to visit, I don't visit those sites anymore. So for most purposes, bookmarks just are completely pointless.
Well, if you do want them when you travel, you just send them to Link-A-Go-Go.
There's ways around it, but actually, can I ask a question? For people who read web pages, does anyone here find themselves reading less and less commercial websites and more blogs? Because, like, I read, you know, I used to go to PC Week, et cetera, et cetera. I find exclusively I'm getting a lot more of my information from blogs, perhaps an embarrassingly large amount of the, of course, Slashdot, because, you know, it's Slashdot.
Well, the blogosphere will find anything interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, like web or commercial websites. If there's anything worth your reading.
If there's anything worth reading. But even so, do you actually even bother going to commercial websites anymore? Because I really don't, and that's very surprising.
Well, there's a link from a blog.
Yeah.
Well, I get a few things, like eWeek, for example. I get their email digest. I never just go to the eWeek website. Again, if something looks interesting in the email digest, then I go to that link. But that's pretty much it. Stuff like that is pretty much it.
Okay. So
I don't even go to CNN anymore.
my girlfriend surfs CNN religiously, and she tells me if there's something interesting that.
I mean, So I mean, there's definitely an interesting thing, and what that's going to do to advertising revenue. Interesting question.
There's not much left.
Well, I know where Google takes me, but Google takes me more and more to blogs because
isn't that interesting?
That's how I think I got in this whole thing in the first place. Is I went to a link via Google and
why is that? Why are they more highly represented?
There's a really good article about that. I think John Udell, wasn't he the one that wrote that article?
Yeah, well, it's on Micro Content News.
Do you understand how Google works?
Yes,
more or
less.
Basically, well, Google does a couple things. They look at inward-bound links and outward-bound links. They also look at currency of update. And a whole bunch of other heuristic metrics that they sort of stuff in there they don't actually admit to. Like, there's a big database of when you search for this term, show this link first. Why? Because someone's deemed it authoritative. There's a whole bunch of these.
They also use DMOS.
Yep, they use DMOS as well. There's like 20-odd heuristics, I think, if I remember the numbers correctly. So anyway, if you think about a blog, right, it's got a lot of outward-bound links, and if it's a popular blog, it's got a lot of inward-bound links. And it's updated frequently, and so that's why they float to the top.
Actually, even just as far as even an unpopular blog will still have an above average number of inward bound links simply because people will tend to link to individual postings far more they would be far more likely to do that than to link to somebody's homepage.
Now, what do they call that, Google spamming or something? What do they call that when they
Google bombing.
Google bombing.
When they do it deliberately.
They deliberately weblog like crazy just to make their stuff float to the top.
No, it's more than that. What they do, they will take a particular term, like they decide that they don't like Cisco, so they use the
VeriSign. A real example. VeriSign.
Yeah.
So everybody put VeriSign sucks or something like that. So go ahead.
Well, okay. I mean, would you like to elaborate on the VeriSign?
What term they put up?
I believe they put VeriSign sucks.
Yeah, I thought that was it.
Or they might have also just done VeriSign. But part of the thing is that happened also with the whole Scientology thing and all that stuff. But what happened is it's a huge fiasco just because VeriSign does suck. But all kinds of. They're just pretty horrible.
They put it as the subject or something, right? And a bunch of people do it, and they might
not necessarily a subject. They put it actually in the linked text, the linked from text, and surround it with a link to some website. For example, in this, let's say I hate Cisco, so I decide that I want Cisco to come first with the term scum sucking pigs. So I put in the phrase scum sucking pigs, it's surrounded with a link to Cisco's front page, and tell people, do the same thing. And if enough people do that on enough weblogs, then if you type in scum sucking pigs into Google, then Cisco's website comes up the first entry.
Yeah, but you know something?
There's different variants of that.
But you know something? If you go to a web page and you see scum sucking pig, it has no credibility anyway. So while from the copyright holder it's kind of bad and annoying, it doesn't really actually matter.
If you want to check out something that's really interesting, go to operatingthetan.com/Google. Or you can search for Google or Scientology on Google. You can search for Scientology and Google bombing. It should be the first.
Right. What they were trying to do there is they wanted to make sure that website critical of Scientology came up.
So if you click on the first link, you'll see what Scientology actually does for their, why they show up at the very top. And you'll see there's actually a whole brouhaha.
Go down to the diagrams.
Yeah, diagrams are pretty wild.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Scientology, Church of Scientology actually has a whole farm of domain names basically just heavily interlinked with each other, basically to replicate the whole weblog,
The scary thing, these are actually real shell organizations, which is the scary thing.
And basically, it's all to make sure that their content comes up first in Google when you search for Scientology.
Well, even though Google is well designed to not do that, to not allow anybody to fool it, because it deals with only links from other people to you.
Yeah, but these look like different people.
If you build a big enough matrix, it'll work.
Yep. We got pitched this for our product from a local
web shop.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people actually specialize.
No, they wanted to, build this.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, there are a lot of companies that specialize in defeating Google.
I mean, in a small way, porn sites have been doing this for quite a while.
They're actually
and that's one
that
thing great about Google.
It's sort of amazing, Google.
They used to just stick all the terms in their page.
It's a huge deal.
Other sites index, right?
Well, no. They also do related websites and try to create extra domain names and gateway pages and
porn sites do this amazingly well.
They tend not to put stuff like this, though. But yeah.
Psychology did it better because they didn't care how much it cost. Okay, it's interesting.
Go ahead.
So basically what the weblogs then did is they basically decided to counteract this by all linking the word Scientology to, Clanbake?
Operation Clanbake, I think.
Which is a website criticizing Scientology. So now if you search for Scientology, what comes up at the top?
Well, showing that basically what happened is then the Church of Scientology slapped the DMCA claim against church, and then Google removed it, the link, and then there's a whole brouhaha. Google put back the link, but not to the exact page.
But you'll notice that if you just search for Scientology, the first link is now a
operation webbing.
Because no matter how much money the Scientologists throw at creating that huge domain name farm, there's more weblogs out there than they can maintain. Websites, at least for any reasonable amount of money.
Google's official policy is to remove from the listing anyone who does, it's the sort of Google bombing, but that doesn't really work. Because they'll kill their children.
These are the natural evolutions. I mean, we all saw that we saw this kind of crap back when Playboy first came out, when people had big issues. We saw it when music videos first came out. It's just media. It all goes through a painful birthing phase. The afterbirth is ugly, as it always is. And then it settles down and becomes a tool for business like everything else.
If the government doesn't get too involved and clamp down on it, that is the big danger.
Well, not even the government, all the corporations. There's actually have been quite a few articles about, how the privatization of the net has been going and all kinds of, fun and interesting stuff about that.
But it's hard for them to fight a grassroots movement without the help of the government,
Well, the government is a tool of large corporations.
Look at the size of the distributed information architecture that's built around the internet. It's really hard to control. So it wouldn't surprise me to see shitty government regulation and will it really matter? I mean, certainly it hasn't stopped everybody at all.
The thing that worries me is, and Larry Lessig was kind of talking about this a little bit in his most recent book.
The Future of Ideas.
I'm sorry?
Future of Ideas.
Future of Ideas. Where cable broadband.
Future of Ideas. If you go to Lessig.org, LESSIG, there's actually a lot of stuff there. Lessig.org.
Which are going to basically destroy the end-to-end principle of the internet, at least at the last mile and a half or so, which, of course, for all intents and purposes, destroys it.
So what you're saying is you won't be able to run personal servers on your...
Oh, it's not that you won't be able to run personal servers, but they'd be able to discriminate against the different categories of content that you're viewing.
Yeah, but they can already use...
Well, people used to say that the net would reroute around it, but, the more you see about it, the more you're like, well, maybe
it's
not.
It's more like freedom of the press belongs to those who own one, so the net will reroute around those things that people who own the wires want to.
That's what community violence.
Well, that's very promising.
That's the whole Wi-Fi stuff is very cool.
Yeah.
And if you look at what's going on with Gorilla.net, without $300 worth of hardware, all of a sudden you're serving the neighborhood. You're not just serving yourself. So, as I said, in all the shapes, we're going through this afterwork process. It sucks. It's ugly. It will get straightened out because there are enough people who want free speech.
Right. But basically, weblogs are a radically decentralized media. Not just a medium, but a decentralized media. And a lot of it is just, you know, 90% of everything is crap. I mean, 90% of everything is crap. Not just everything on the web.
That's about 95%.
Well, I mean, most of the books that are published are crappy, and out of print. Most of the songs that are written are crap. Most of the tunes are uncomfortable. But the good stuff does blow through the crap. And the same is simple as weblogs and web in general. One of the nice things about Google is that it basically accelerates the coding process. And I think they're going on the right track there. There's plenty of other opportunities to quote stuff to the top, both within individual websites, within collections of websites, and within the web as a whole. And that is, in essence, part of the main goal of knowledge management. Sure that the stuff that you actually are looking for comes at you when you look for it. Of course, you know, the other goal of knowledge management is to tell you the stuff you didn't know that you needed to know, and so you didn't ask for it, but yeah, that's kind of
really important.
Yeah. A couple of people have proposed various sort of serendipity filters on news feeds and news aggregators to try to predict what you might be interested in. I haven't seen any implementations of those, whether good or bad implementations, but I'd be very interested.
There's a bunch of them. Most of the stuff doesn't work all that well. It's like most advanced search stuff, it doesn't really work. Or when it works in such a highly vertical application you're unaware of it. But it'll get there. I mean,
Google works, so eventually, you know, somebody will come up with a
apps.
Google works now. Maybe it's just people haven't figured out how to subvert it.
People are now figuring out how to subvert it. And it's expensive to subvert.
Yeah.
So when people actually, when the cost of that drives down, or you know, what Google will have to do at some point is they'll have to start doing trace routing. And seeing, okay, is this really a virtual host in the same box? If so, I would actually discount it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're doing constant development at Google, too, so they're not standing still. I mean, they have the largest number of PhDs in their percentage. Yeah.
And they're really smart, so they'll figure it out. And they own search for now. If not, someone else will pop up. Because don't forget, every time the net's gotten really bad to search, someone has popped up.
Yeah, I mean, so far it's gotten better and better, not worse. So
it got worse for a little while.
Yeah.
But, you know, first you had Yahoo, and then AltaVista was kind of cool for a while, et cetera.
Yeah. I still, every so often, end up using AltaVista's Boolean search options when Google doesn't give me the answer that I'm looking for. Because I know, when I'm looking for a specific document that I have no idea where I saw it, but I know which words that were in it, and I have some idea as to what the actual phrase was. But it's something that nobody else has ever linked to. I'm at that point, if I haven't been able to find it in Google, I have at least a 50% chance of being able to find it in AltaVista using their Boolean search capability.
We all seem to have collectively run out of energy. Because this did go twice as long as it was supposed to go.
Well, my brain's buzzing with ideas, but it's going to take me a day to digest them all.
Oh, was it 8 to 9?
Yeah.
That was 8 to 9.
No. I gave this block a 2-hour block, because I really didn't know how many people were going to show up. I figured we'd always end it early if you want.
That's true.
Well, we can still talk about trust networks or collaborative filtering.
Yes, we use it. So, thank you all for coming.
Yes.
And
you've all done very well.
Yeah, although, I mean...
I mean, is corrosion doing anything from software?
Corrosion is they're doing some interesting stuff. They're actually their moderation system works pretty well.
No,
it is sort of interesting when people.
I find it, but no, it's pretty well.
Yeah.
So what do you find there?
I've got a smooth learning curve.
Okay.
I find the Corrosion has a.
Now, do you know David Milman?
A good step at the beginning.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the whole. I mean, because it's the interface problem. I mean, people go to like /Corrosion, they don't understand. Slashdot's moderation. Yeah, they've actually Corrosion is the new improved version. Yeah, and Slashdot is the they don't care about making it better. Which is interesting. Yeah, like actually, there was something sort of like that discussion at South by Southwest. There's always that's been one of my interests. I've actually done some work on that. But you like people wonder why don't you have like something that combines the best of you know Avogadro and the best of you know like Corrosion and although you know clearly you know Brian Aker is actually working on some semi-interesting stuff in Slashdot. They added. You know, the friends and foe system. And they're actually going to use the friends and foe system as a sort of a true trust web net, a trust metric where it's actually going to propagate now. One of the things that's a huge problem with trust metrics is that's enormously expensive to calculate. And that's a problem. Also, part of the thing, too, is that, and there's always a problem, is that if you got the perfect filtering, perfect collaborative filtering, you know, mechanism, there'd be no way that you'd ever see a dissenting view in an opinion.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so there is the problem with something that's perfectly predicted that'll give you everything you want to see. You're gonna end up with you know basically either a monoculture or you know yeah. It, so that in itself actually causes some problems where you don't. In order to be truly successful, it has to.
I think of the product we're working on.
Project.